Jeff and Dana Siffer, and you're listening to the Camera Dojo Podcast with Carrie Garrison.
You're listening to Camera Dojo, the official podcast of CameraDojo.com, where we help you make the most out of your photography. This is your host, Carrie Garrison, and this is episode 77. And we just got back from WPPI, the Wedding and Portrait Photographers International Show out in Las Vegas, Nevada. Had a great time out there. It's always fun hooking up with everybody, meeting with the vendors, going to the conferences, and of course, just networking with other people. It's a huge, huge show. And if you're doing any type of photography, there is something for you at this show. It is just a great, great experience, from processing to printing to technique, you name it, it's there. And we got to hook up with a bunch of companies out there, see what's going on. And I've been posting video interviews on CameraDojo.com. We've got one from an interview with Pocket Wizard, a interview with Jim Collins, the CEO of Pictage. Let's see what else we got coming up. We got a demo of lighting, so you can kind of see what David Zeiser was doing out there in the Westcott booth. And I think we got a couple more that are coming up over the next couple days. So be sure and check out all of the video interviews from WPPI. Also recently, we posted an article on the My Passport Studio hard drive for Macintosh from Western Digital, which is a cool drive that we saw out at PMA. And we've also been posting the new Tamron videos. So Tamron has been setting out to do a bunch of educational videos lately. And the first one was getting to know your camera. The second one is on autofocus functions, and there's a bunch more, and we're posting those as well. So we've got a lot of great content coming up, a lot of great podcasts coming up. So stick with us and see what's coming up on CameraDojo.com. In the meantime, we're going to have a special guest today, and we will talk about him right after the break. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Today, we are here with Scott Robert Lim, a fantastic photographer. He does a lot of workshops, a mentoring program, a bunch of other things that we'll get into. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. It's such a pleasure to be part of this podcast and what you're doing, and I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
So, Scott, why don't you give people a little bit of background about yourself for those who don't know who you are?
You know what? I am just a regular guy, I guess. 10 years ago, my wife quit her high-paying job, and we decided to start our family. And we wanted to start our family by adopting children, which is very expensive. So we blew all our savings to adopt our first child. And she quit her high-paying job, and at the time, I was making $10,000 living in Los Angeles and owning a house, and I said to myself, you know what? I might need to do something else to supplement our income. And I said, what could I do on the weekend that makes a few bucks, and so I wouldn't have to quit my other extremely high-paying job, which I was making $10,000 a year from. And I thought of, you know, I love photography. Maybe I could be a wedding photographer. So with that notion in mind, I practiced for a whole year, and that's when digital kind of came into play, and my first camera was a Coolpix 800, I believe, a 2-megapixel camera that I paid $550 for, and started off with a 32 megabyte card. And I took about 1,000 pictures a month. But listen, remember film versus digital? Digital recorded all your settings. So I could actually learn from what I shot. And so I just did that for about a whole year. And at the end of the year, I mentioned to the friend, I think I'm ready to go into the wedding business. I feel somewhat confident. If you know anybody interested, then give me a call. I called a friend and mentioned this. And he said, hey, I know somebody getting married. And one thing led to another. I got the job. I got a whopping $1,100 for my first job. I was on cloud nine, and for a guy making, you know, $10,000 a year to get $1,100 for your first wedding. But again, you know, I was using film too, so I did spend $300 in film. And then I hired two assistants to help me and paid them, you know, $500. I did make a few dollars at the end. But anyways, that's what kind of started my journey. And I did something a little bit different. I kind of was in computers a little bit. And back 10 years ago, I actually created a portable slideshow for this couple with music and everything. And back 10 years ago, slideshows on the computer weren't that prevalent like they are now. And so every single person that came into her house, she sat them down in front of her computer and made them watch my slideshow.
Nice.
That set it off. And then one person told another person, and I just really got into the whole thing and developed from there. And now I'm so privileged to shoot around the world with weddings and get to speak and educate people and mentor people in this process of becoming a lead photographer, you know, a person who wants to earn, you know, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $10,000 a wedding and actually, you know, have a living doing this. And so I feel so privileged. So I'm really honored that you would want to speak to me and allow me to share a little bit about what I know.
Well, Scott, you brought up what I think is a very important point in what you just talked about, in that you did something that separated you from other people, which generated the referral business.
Yeah.
Versus what a lot of people try and do now, which is spend tons of money on learning how to do search engine optimization, getting their Google ranking and all that, versus the traditional way, and in my opinion, the more profitable way of going. Instead of spending all the time and energy and resources on Google ranking, and got referrals.
Yeah, you know, I had of course, before I went into photography, I had a business for 12 years that I was running, and it wasn't that it wasn't, you know, as everybody knows, when they start a business, as it grows, it gets hungrier, and you have to feed it. And that's the reason why I wasn't bringing a lot of money home, because that business was growing and we had to keep on throwing more and more money into it. But for 12 years, I had been doing my own business, and I realized we spent literally, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars on advertisement. And so we knew the best advertisement really was doing a good job and then having people rave about you. And so you kind of just need something of excellence for a person to rave about. And so I knew I was kind of into computers and things like that. And so I liked slideshows and I knew the power of them. And so I just tried to do it really well. And then it led into that rave. And really, there's no shortcuts with this business. You really just have to, I'm not sure if people read the book Outliners. Have you read that book?
I have not.
Yeah, but it talks about how famous people really make it. And they said, you got to spend a minimum of 10,000 hours doing something before you even start to get good at it, which working full time, if you're working full time, that would be 5 years of doing it. So it's there's no shortcuts of being good. And he gave examples of Tiger Woods and of Bill Gates and all these different people. So it's really interesting. And I really wholeheartedly believe in that, is that I see a lot of photographers wanting to get take the shortcut, but there are no shortcuts.
But are you saying I can't go buy a kit camera with a its onboard flash and go shoot weddings right away?
You guess you can start there, but if you really want to earn a living, doing it and you want to provide for your family and you want to have health care and all that kind of stuff, it would be a little bit difficult. Because it's, you know, like they say, they have the, what is it, the 20-80 rule, that 20% of the people make 80% of the revenue. And so it's only really the top 20% that make anything. But I think in fields where everybody wants to do it, everybody wants to be a photographer. That would be the dream of everybody. So when it's highly competitive, it's more like the 595 rule. And yeah. You really don't have a chance making it in this industry unless you're the very, very best at it. And that's what I really try to impress on the people that I mentor is like, listen, you've got to be better than 90 out of 100 photographers. So how many photographers are in this room right now? You got to be better than 90% of them if you're going to make it.
So do the math on that. At WPPI this week, there was 15,000 photographers there.
Yeah.
You know, and they were all trying to figure out what they can do to separate themselves from the rest to be better than the other people. And it was almost sad in a couple senses. You and I talked about this before, about a lot of the seminars and workshops and things there had to do with marketing and branding and promotion, self-promotion and all that versus actually getting better at your craft.
Yeah. And I think that's the message that really shouldn't be lost, is that it's like we should enjoy getting better at our craft. And everything results from that. And so, and that's really what's going to elevate the whole industry, is us getting better at our craft and not, you know, whatever, blogging better, or I don't know, having better site optimization or whatever. But it's really about us getting better at that craft. And that's going to elevate the whole industry, where we're all going to make more money.
Well, I know when I'm selling a wedding job, if I lost that job to somebody and I looked at their work and I went, wow, that guy's good.
Yeah.
If I don't mind losing to someone who is actually a better photographer, that never bothers me.
Right. That never bothers me at all either. And so that, I know, I think we can live with that. I think the problem is that there's a lot of people all at the same level right now. And so people are trying to find ways to be better than the next guy, because everybody work actually kind of looks the same now. And so instead of going the traditional route of actually getting better and learning about posing and learning about lighting and learning how to use your equipment and so forth, it's easy for us to kind of take shortcuts and say, well, let me just get my site higher ranked, or let me just, blog a little bit better, or whatever it is. I mean, certainly that helps, but the core skills must be there still. And I liken it to a restaurant. You never go to a restaurant and you say, oh my gosh, that food at this restaurant that I went to, it's so mediocre. Oh man, you should go to it. It has mediocre service. It's the best thing. No one does that. And so you got to kind of see your business as a restaurant. And what they always tell me in the restaurant business, if a restaurant is advertising, that means they're not very good, right? Because all the best restaurants are referral based. And so I think that's how it is as a photographer. Most of our business comes from a referral base, and that's how we get the high-end jobs. All of my jobs that, you know, where I've, you know, made over $10,000 with, they've all been through a referral. No one just said, oh, I just found you on the internet.
Well, certainly. I mean, I look at some of the big now. I'm in Southern California. We have some of the top wedding photographer names out here. And I would be willing to bet that I'm going to ran off a list of names. I'll bet you none of those shot a wedding this past year that came in off of Google. Frank Salas, Jeremy Lucero, Becker,
yeah,
Jessica Clare,
right,
Jasmine Starr, Mike Colon.
Right,
how many
right,
of these
right.
guys are getting jobs off Google?
I don't know the numbers, but yeah, you're probably right about that. I mean, I just going to know from my own personal experience, my best jobs were always from a referral. and my best opportunities were always from a referral. And so that's the way I treat the business. And, you know, luckily for me, I started my business, this photography business, when I was 37, a little bit older. And I've been kicked around and, you know, tossed to the curb, you know, a million times. And so I've just kind of learned from my mistakes. And I know that the tried and true way is really kind of referral based. And to get a referral, you have to produce excellence in some way at your craft. And that's what I'm really all about, of trying to teach people and to produce excellence.
Well, what are some of the things that people can do that is going to improve their images? What do you think the one thing they should really focus on,
okay,
as kind of a starting point?
Right. The number one thing and the easiest thing is they've got to think about is getting the light off the camera. That is huge. And so whenever they're thinking about lighting something or using light, it shouldn't be light that's directly on the camera. Because if you think about it, this world is lit by what? The sun. It's like a huge off-camera light source. And the reason why off-camera is so great is that it actually creates shadows. And shadows actually is what defines light and dimension and tonality and drama. And when you start getting the light off the camera, then all this drama comes into the photo, and it creates a picture that's a lot more natural and has impact. And it's just a simple thing that people should learn how to master is using off-camera light.
Yeah, I think over the last couple of years, there's certainly been a huge trend in the types of diffusers and modifiers to go on your flash that's on your camera in order to eliminate shadows.
Right, and just kind of evenly light everything with soft light. Yeah.
I mean, that's okay sometimes, but every image shouldn't look like that.
No, I mean, there's a place for that when you're shooting group shots, say, or you're doing a snapshot of a couple people together. I mean, that's fine because that's better, you know, than just simply blasting them with a flash, but to make it soft and have a nice shot. But when you really want to create drama and impact, you have to see shadows. It gives dimension to, it creates, especially when you're shooting a bride. Okay, first of all, everybody wants to look thinner. And the way that you kind of define a person's shape is by with a shadow. That bride has spent like 8 months looking for that dress. That usually the dress is all white. Well, how are you going to show the detail in that dress? You can't. How are you going to show her lovely shape? She's been going to the gym 3 times a week to look that way. How are you going to show that off? You can only do it if you by shadow, because she's wearing all white. And so you're going to make, when you learn these techniques, you're going to make your bride or whoever you shoot look skinnier, thinner, better with dimension, and they're going to love you for it. And that's what's going to really create the rave for you.
I think a lot of people get really intimidated by trying to move into off-camera flash. They think, well, I'm how many flashes do I need? Do I need 2? Do I need 3? Do I need 6? You know,
yeah.
Can people really just start with 1 and move up?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. You can start off. I mean, that's how I started. I mean, I think you should start off with 1. Sometimes when I do my lectures and I'm showing these images that have 3 flashes or 4 flashes, and I go, you know what? Never go into a situation and say, hey, I'm going to use 4 flashes here. You know, you always start with, okay, start with the subject first. Okay, how am I going to light the subject? So I light the subject. Oh, you know what? I think I need a little bit of separation now, light now. And then kind of build it from there. But always just starts with 1. Just start basic. Start with the subject first and then build from there. And then all of a sudden, you'll start to see a scene differently. And then you can go into a situation and go, you know what? I'm going to light this. I have this idea. I have this vision for this shot. And I think I'm going to need about 3 flashes. But that's, you know, that's all starts from doing 1 first. And it's very easy to do that, actually. It's a lot easier than people think.
Well, a couple episodes ago, we had Silarina on the show, and he's, you know, huge into the strobe type or the speed lighting techniques, and he's got the new site speedlighting.com.
Right.
And he recommends starting off with a TTL extension cord, and he talked about one from flashzebra.com,
okay,
which is a 24-foot DTTL cord. I mean, that's huge. I mean, now you don't have to worry about buying wireless flashes or wireless, you know, triggers and all that, and dealing with all that. You just put one on your on the hot shoe, the other one put on the bottom of the flash, and you can take that thing 24 feet.
Definitely.
It's rare that you're going to need more than 24 feet. I mean, that's huge. And I'm trying to look up that cable right now. If I remember right, it was really cheap, too, in comparison to a lot of other things. It was, let's see, a 5-meter cord was it's something like, $25
right,
for 24 foot cord.
Just to get started.
Yeah. Do you think that's a great way of starting, or should people just jump right into Pocket Wizards and?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's an awesome way to start, to get that, just to practice with. That's what I did. I had a PC cable and just hooked it up to a flash, and boom, there it was. And just experiment with it and go it out with that. But you know what? Actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because I've actually got this system of wireless system that I've been using for all of, you know, a lot of my award-winning shots and everything. I've been using this very inexpensive system. $24 is really cheap. But through this system of these Pocket Wizards types that I've used, you can actually get a whole system that will trigger 3 flashes and also include, like, very good manual flashes and do the whole works for under $200.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, and this is just going old school, you know, finding $30 flashes on the internet and on eBay, you know, like a, you know, 285, Vivitar 285s. There's a lot of the Sunpaks. There's a ton of Sunpaks, 422, 433, 383, that have just the simple manual on the back, you know, that go 16th power, 8th power, quarter power. That's really all you need. And that's kind of the reason why I kind of came out with this new book on mastering flash photography, of how people in a very inexpensive way can use a wireless system and get really tremendous results out of it using a manual system. Because a lot of times when you go to TTL, it's great. I believe TTL is great, especially for one flash. But sometimes when you're using multiple flashes, I find it better to go manually. And my analogy is that there's an M on your camera dial, right? It stands for manual. And
but there's P for professional.
Well, I use that too. But there's times where we want to use the M, and it will always be part of the DSLR. And that's what I think what it is with flash photography, is that everybody should at least learn a manual system. Because sometimes we want exact creative control. And that's what a manual system will able to do for you. Because in a manual system, you can control flash 4 ways. You can control it by your distance, by your ISO, by your f-stop, and what's the other one? Distance, ISO, f-stop, and...
Size,
yes. But whereas if you go to a TTL system, the only way you can control is by EV. And so, but sometimes the situation is complicated, that the camera is not as good as your eye.
Yeah.
And so you can't decipher what you really want to create. And so that's why, like, you know, let's say you're on manual and you shoot and you take it, it triggers the flash and it's a little bit hot. Okay, I have 2 ways to control that right away. I can just move that light stand back a little bit and make it less powerful, or I could increase my f-stop a little bit more, and that will cut down the power on the flash. So right there, easily, I have 2 ways to control that flash. Whereas if I was in TTL mode, all I could do is adjust my EV control. But if the camera is not seeing what I want to happen, sometimes it's not going to fit exactly. It's going to be close most of the time. But I just feel that it's very important for everybody to kind of learn the basics before they proceed into everything. And this is a great way to get started, especially, you know, camera equipment is expensive. And if you don't have all the money in the world, learning how to do flash manually is really the best way to learn because it's not expensive and it's you really, really understand the concepts of light. And so when you go to a TTL system, you're not going to get flustered if it doesn't work. You just can simply switch back to a manual and then figure it out and make it work.
But I think people are really scared about trying to go manual because they don't really know where to begin.
How do you
know how to adjust the flash? How do you know what camera settings to use? Where trying to get started in just even moving to the M mode is just terrifying.
It is extremely terrifying for people. And that is the whole reason, the crux of why I created this awesome book on manual flash. That's the whole purpose of, because I've been teaching a whole year on manual flash and I've been seeing students all around the world. And so I would kind of evaluate the things that they would get stumped on. And so I put this learning guide together, which I really feel is a complete guide on how to use a manual flash together. And it's revolutionary in that I put it together in a PDF form. And so I would talk about white balance. But if you didn't know about white balance, you would click that link and it would bring you to another live website talking all about white balance. And then also I could put audio on it. So I recorded my voice and I would talk about certain things because sometimes talking about it is easier than reading about it. And then also on top of that, I put live video clips in it of people watching me in action shoot, which is learning there too. So what I tried to do was to bring what it's like to be at my workshop and put it all into one little universal PDF. And so I think it's quite revolutionary, and I'm really excited to tell people about it and show it. And so far I've gotten some really great reviews on it, and people seem to really like it.
Yeah, we're going to make sure that we have links and things to where to find that. It's available on Amazon. It's only $39. And we'll talk a little bit more about that at the end, as well as check the show notes, and there'll be links on where you can find this package from it. It does look really, really good. You've got diagrams and things on how to do different lighting setups. And I think it looks like it's going to be a really good learning tool for some people. You're even recommending that people can start off with what I like to refer to as poverty wizards.
Yes, definitely. I totally believe in that. I mean, I've been using poverty wizards for a whole year in every professional situation. And I've been getting great results.
Yeah, I went with the cactus ones that I found. I mean, they were really cheap. They're about $14 per unit. And most of the time they worked perfect, but I took them to a wedding reception and it was down in a basement and they simply would not work. I think there was interference with the DJ equipment and I was so bummed.
I think what it is that the Cactus ones are like the little bit older technology, but within the last year or 6 months, they've really, really improved the technology. And now they have 4-channel systems and 16-channel systems. And so they're really working well on finding a channel that won't interfere with the DJ and so forth. And but, you know, they're really inexpensive, and I think it's a great place to start. And then if you got a little bit more cash and you want to go with the Pocket Wizards, and that's fine too. But, you know, not everybody is – it's about, you know, being able to create your vision. And sometimes to create your vision, you need a lot of equipment. You might need 3 or 4 flashes and whatever, but sometimes you run out of money to feed your vision. And this is where this comes into play, where you can kind of do that. You create your vision, and then you get paid more, and then, you know, you can buy the more expensive equipment. But all the equipment is good now if you know how to use it. You know, go ahead.
We're talking about manual flash and the manual settings on there, even though, you know, there's P for professional and A for awesome. But when we're in manual and we're trying to get the lighting right, do you recommend people learn how to use a light meter?
Not really. I go through my book and how to calculate certain things. Like, for example, if you want to determine your f-stop, it's a good way. How I do it is you start with the guide number on your flash.
Oh, now you're really going to freak people out.
I know. I'm freaking them all out. But, you know, most those guide numbers on flash, it's really easy, okay? So most guide numbers on your flash tend to be 100 to 120. And I would say in general, I in my book, I kind of use example of 120, which is the standard Vivitar 383, the 285, the cult classics are usually around 120. And so simply, if you multiply your f-stop times the distance, how far away it is, so let's say you're 8 feet away and you're at F8, that would be 8 times 8 is 64. So your flash would need to be at a guide number of 64, which is one half of a power, one half, which is one quarter the power of a flash. And so I just have these simple numbers. It just breaks it up, you know, everything down to like five stops. And if you can remember these five stops with these correlating guide numbers, you definitely could figure out on the fly in general where to start with real easily, about 90% of the time.
That's an excellent way of doing it. I mean, I don't know about the Nikons. I'm sure their guide numbers are in the manuals. But with Canon flashes, the first two digits of the model number are the guide number. So a 430 is a 43. I only learned this week.
Right.
Into them. So,
but that's by meters now, right? So
right.
If you want to convert that to feet, you just multiply it times three or three.
Exactly.
Yeah,
you'll get that. At least Canon people can look at their flash and figure out what their guide number is going to be.
Got it.
So,
and so it's just a general guess. I mean, so what? You're off a little bit, right? So
the
great thing about manual is if you're off a little bit, you start off there. If you're a little bit strong, you move back a little bit. If you're a little bit not strong enough, you can move forward or you can adjust the flash power by f-stop. People don't realize that.
But what you're trying to get people to do with learning the guide numbers is give them a starting point.
A starting point. That's all it is. And then after you do that for one or two days, just walk around doing it, you just kind of know it in your head. You look around, okay, that's probably like a quarter power or whatever. And I also tell them about the Sunny 16 rule.
Ah, the good old Sunny 16.
So I just work with the Sunny 16 rule and guide numbers. And so, you know what I mean? So if it looks like a F8 sky out there, you know, overcast and shadows barely shadows in it, then I'm going to be at F8 and then I'm going to set my flash at one quarter and put them 8 feet away. And I start with that. How easy is that?
Yeah. For those who don't remember what the Sunny 16 rule is, I'll put a link to it in the show notes because I did a whole article on it a while back.
Oh,
it's very simple. So you want to talk about it real quick?
Yeah, basically in the old days before the days of the sophisticated metering on cameras and everything, photographers would actually go out and look at the sky and determine the f-stop.
No way.
And the exposure. You can actually do it.
No.
Yes, you can.
And how?
It's easier than you think it is. Well, basically you set your shutter speed to your ISO. And in this case, I recommend 100 ISO, 100 shutter speed. And then you go out, if it's bright light and it's sunny and you see sharp shadows on the ground, you're at F16. Is that easy enough?
Pretty easy. The ISO equals shutter F16, sunny 16.
Sharp shadows. You see shadows on their line. They're very distinct. They're very sharp. You're at 16. Okay, a little bit less. You start to see a little bit of edge on the shadow. Maybe there's some overcast and a slight cloud breakup. You're probably at F11. Then you're seeing a little bit more overcast. Then you're probably, and you see slight, you barely see a shadow on somebody. Then you're kind of at F8. And then if it's completely overcast, you're at F6. And so if you know the f-stop according to each of those, if you know the flash power according to each of those f-stops, you're in. So I know F16, I just set my flash onto full. And I'm 8 feet back.
And of course, that flash should be directly behind your head, straight shooting straight at the subject, right?
No. We're talking about shadows, right? And a way to create shadows is to move the light off axis of the camera. So you don't want it directly over your head. You want it off to the side so you could see the dimension on the face or the dress or whatever.
Because very rarely when we're shooting is the sun directly over our head right behind us.
Right.
So there, you want to make it look more natural.
Yes, that's the whole thing, is making it look like, and that's what I say in the book. It's like the number one reason why you want to kind of use flash photography. It's literally like having a pocket sunset, and you just pull it out whenever you need a sunset.
But what about
so much power in that?
There's certainly a group of people out there, and I'm not trying to degrade them at all, who go, well, I'm a natural light shooter. I don't need flash.
Can I be honest?
Sure.
I think that works great for certain situations, but really that's the lazy man's way out of it. Because we're about creating our vision, and lighting is so much place. When you're going into area with flat light, how are you going to create any drama at that? So what if your ISO is 100,005? If it's flat light, it's flat light. It's going to be dull. So in order to create drama in your photo, a lot of times you need to, you know, get in some light source that will kind of spotlight that subject or create that rim light around them and create – flat light is just killer. If you want to have a website with mediocre imagery that has no wow to it, use flat light. Use light with no contrast in it. Use light that doesn't create any shadows. And sometimes, of course, if you find the light, if you can find the light, you can get away not using your flash, which I do all the time. But in a lot of situations, you're going to find that the light is flat and you need to create the drama. You need to create the impact. And so that's why we need to use flash.
Is there any type of rule of thumb when we're creating these shadows into how much of a difference there should be from the highlight side to the shadow side of somebody?
Well, I guess you're just opening up a whole can of worms there, I guess. But, I think it just kind of goes with personal taste too, and what you're trying to, you know, obviously, if you're trying to create a more masculine feel, then a lot of times, you know, for guys, you want that split lighting where half their face is in shadow, and that works good because we as guys, we don't look that good, so the more we cover up, the better the picture. But you know, no, generally if you look at, say, headshots of guys, they usually use split lighting because it has a more masculine feel. And then there's the Rembrandt lighting, which I like to use a lot, where you get that little triangular shadow on the cheekbone there. And that's mm-hmm. in general what I kind of look for when I'm photographing a woman or just somebody in general. But it goes by kind of taste in what you're doing. And then again, the type of light that you use affects those shadows, whether or not you're going to do straight with the flash or add an umbrella or a softbox. And so there's all that good stuff that you can get into, which makes us excited once we start finding out about it, because we start to feel the power that we have. We're in control of the situation. And that's what's the exciting part about photography, is being able to execute your vision, learning real skills, and then being able to execute your vision and saying, I had this photo in my mind and I was able to create it. And that you feel so powerful. You feel so enabled when you do that.
So, man, that was great. I actually lost my original train of thought. Sorry. What kind of position from me to if I'm the shooter, from me to my light, 45
right.
degrees, and what kind of distance,
yeah.
down? What are there some real simple tips that we can use to just get started in practicing with some of these techniques?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing you should do maybe is really start off with the TTL system. Because that's going to be the easiest, and just so you can see the quality of light in using one flash.
And so, like you said, probably, you know, for $24, you could get that cord, and everybody's probably got a TTL flash that will work with their camera, and get it off your camera. And yeah, and just like maybe four. Okay, so let's see. Let's say if I was at 12 o'clock and my subject was in the middle of the dial, of the clock dial, then maybe if you're at either 2 o'clock or try even going to 5 o'clock, and just do going in between there and looking at the quality of light that's being generated out of that, those different, you know, positions, that's a good start. So you could go from 2 to 5, or you can go from 2 o'clock or 10 o'clock to 7 o'clock, say, and just go and just experiment with how the light hits your subject and what kind of shadow is. And a real basic thing that I like to teach in general is, it took me actually several years to figure this out and fumbling around, but, you know, I always keep the nose towards the light source. That way you don't get that funky shadow across the nose onto your subject, and then you kind of can get that Rembrandt lighting too at the same time. So I kind of just say, you know, start off at the 10 o'clock position or the 2 o'clock position, put the subject's body away from the light, and then the face, the nose towards the light. And the reason why you want to put the body away from the light is then you're going to create shadows on their body, and you're going to see their contour if the body is away from the light. The face towards the light, and then you're going to get the Rembrandt shadow on the cheek.
So let's take a look at a couple of your images. Does that sound like a good idea? I'm going to point out a couple of ones that I mean, you have a wide range from some really fine art looking pieces, but there's also some really good, strong portraiture images that I think we can point out that can help make some of these points for us. The first one is Vintage Abigail.
Okay.
And this is a shot of a young lady. She's sitting in what looks to be an old, you know, like 40s Ford or something. And the light appears to be coming in from the front windshield. Can you kind of talk us through the light setup and why you chose this particular lighting?
Okay, that was like a 1920s car. I had a workshop in the UK, and this guy who owned the car automobile shop said, hey, you can come in here and shoot our cars and whatever. So, of course, we all crawled in there and started taking pictures. And this was actually a student. She wasn't one of our models, but at the end of the course, all the female students want nice pictures of themselves too. So she got in there, she bought this special dress, and it's like, hey, we need to do this vintage feel. And the light in there was extremely flat. You know, hey, we're in London, right? Overcast, not a lot of sun. So what I had to do, I had to create drama. So what I did was I had a flashlight on me. It wasn't even flash. It was just a flashlight that we had, a xenon gun flashlight,
like a video light type.
It's like a video light. It could be like a video light. And I had someone hold that light, and, you know, and shine it right at her face. And I didn't like the light, the video light directly on her. So I said, listen, let's feather this light. So I had my assistant put half the flash above the roof and half the flash on her. So I would get that bottom half of the light, which is more the softer feathered light, and that's what was on her. And then I created that shot, and I made sure that you know, I saw the short side shadow, which means that the shadow is on the seeing the shadow while you shoot that profile shot, which is going to give dimension to her face. And that's how I created that shot, and I actually won an award for that at WPPI last year. So I'm really proud of that shot. But that was just some simple tools. It was just like a video light and just, you know, the basic concepts of, you know, doing a portrait, doing a headshot.
Yeah, I like that one because it does demonstrate doing a little bit of shadow off the nose to pull that off a little bit. If she had been in that same position, but the light was on the opposite side, so you had reduced that shadow, it would have made her nose disappear into her face.
That's true. That's totally true with that.
So, okay, let's take a look at another one. This is going to have a lot more dramatic lighting on it based on the way you created the shadows. And this one is Portrait of Amber.
Okay, and that's that's the one in Paris, I believe, where she's on the ground. Yes, definitely.
Lady, she looks like she's sitting on maybe a stair. She's got a white wedding dress on.
Yes,
and
yes.
It's just shadows everywhere in here, underneath her arms, on the side of her face. I mean, it almost looks like she's got a strip light on her of some kind. This is a great one just because it shows so much dimensionality into this.
This one here, this is kind of like when you kind of understand light, you can do a lot of sophisticated lighting setups with just basically using your natural light. So what we went in, this is a workshop I did in Paris, and we rented this huge mansion. It was an amazing mansion. So we got the whole run of this. It was like a mansion museum. And there's so many darn museums in Paris. We picked this one that was off a little ways, and we got this whole huge mansion for the whole day for a ridiculous price. And so we're shooting in there. And basically, there's just side light coming from the – there's windows on each side of her. And that side light is coming in on her. So that's why I positioned her there, because I wanted side light. And so you're getting side light, you know, where her back is. And then you're getting side light where her hands are kind of pointing. And then what I did to open it up a little bit was I had somebody take a video light and put it on her face.
Mm. Okay.
And that was it. It was all natural light and one little video light just right on her face to open that up. And I took the shot.
Because that one really stands out and has a whole lot of, like I said, there's some really deep shadows in the dress. There's deep shadows under her arms. It gives a very dramatic feel to it.
And that's what you do. And so what most people don't realize is you don't need a whole heck of a lot of light to take a great picture, especially with digital. And that if you would have saw that, most students go into that situation, and that's why it's really good to go out with a master or somebody who knows about lighting to show you the quality of light that you need. It was hardly any light at all, but because if you know light, you know you can take a picture there, and it's just barely any type of light, but it was the right type of light. And because of your digital camera now, you could go up to ISO 800, even 1600, and take an awesome photo and still blow it up however large you want to do it. And that's the case with this. It's this, you look for the quality light a lot of times, and the amount of it is not too terribly important. But as long as the quality of light is there, with today's technology, you can grab some amazing shots.
Yeah, the next one I want to point out is one that many of us would be in a situation for. It looks like a wedding reception. It's called Lovers by Dance Light. And
okay,
what I see all the time is when photographers are shooting their receptions, the only additional light they have is their accessory light on top of their camera. And if you had just shot this with just the light on the camera, he would be very flat. The room would be very flat. You'd have highlights coming towards the camera on everything. And this looks like maybe there might have been some fill light coming from the camera side, but there's a much stronger light source coming from camera right.
You must be a master of light.
I love
light. Because you're right on.
I love light.
Yes, whenever I do a reception, I set up off-camera strobes. And so there's a strobe off to the right in the back. And I set, what I do is I set my flash on like maybe minus 1 2/3 EV. So I just kiss a little bit of light in the front. And that's how I usually do my reception setups.
Just enough to keep from having...
Minus 1 2/3 exposure, TTL, on-camera, diffused light, whether you want to put whatever Tupperware on there or just put diffuser or whatever or put it up. I think basically I'm just shooting it up to the ceiling and just pulling out my little diffuser. You know that little white diffuser flap? I kind of use that as a white card. And just pull that up, and so I get a little front light that way.
Yeah, what does Canon call it? The catch light card.
Catch light card, yeah, whatever, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And, so, and, But that's a great example of something that the average wedding photographer can do very easily to really add a lot of dimension to these basic reception shots.
Yeah, I hear photographers all the time saying, I don't even like shooting a reception. I go, why not? That's where all the drama is. That's where all the fun is.
That's when you get
to
play.
It's because you're just... Yeah, and that's when you're – that's – if you set up the lighting, you can set up the lighting and you can get some amazing shots. I won a lot of award-winning shots just from the reception because, you know, I just set up, you know, off-camera flash and have fun with it.
Yeah, I think that's really the time that you can experiment because you can't experiment during a ceremony. I mean, you got to get the shots.
No.
You don't have a lot of flexibility. You may not be able to bring in additional lighting. You just don't have the flexibility that you do during the reception to rate. Well, what happens if I raise the light up more? What happens if I bring it down? What happens if I move it over here? What happens? You can do so much during a reception. Make sure you get your safe shots. But man, then that's the time to have fun.
Oh, yeah. And that's the time to have experiment. And when I tell my students, it's like, guess what? Don't worry about it. Everybody thinks that the wedding is sometimes it's like you only got one chance. You know, so guess what? Sometimes I set up the lighting and I totally miss the first dance because all my lighting is off. All I do is I pull them out on the dance floor. I say, listen, can I have 2 minutes again? I talk to the DJ and say, hey, can you play this music again? And I just have them go out there. If I miss the first dance, I recreate again. Just do it again. And so don't. What I tell wedding photographers is don't be timid. Just go out there. There's really nothing that you can't recreate again. Oh, you missed the kiss on the ceremony. Big deal. You can recreate it again, you know. And so there's not really a lot of things that you can't recreate that are important. And so it's just important to have fun and to stretch yourself and not to really worry about it, to bog yourself down, but to really just be creative with every wedding that you shoot.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, even in a really dark, last year I had some killer ones where the ceremony place was so dark. I mean, I told them, like, look, none of these shots are going to turn out. So we're going to stage them at the end. We stage ring, we stage the kiss, we stage a couple other ones.
Right.
Boom, we got it because we were able to bring the lighting in afterwards. What can you
do? Well, I bet you those shots were a lot better than shooting it live.
They were awesome, yeah.
Why? Because you're able to use more of your vision and your lighting and control the situation with that. And, you know, that's what, you know, people have this kind of, I started out kind of shooting a wedding photojournalistically, but as I got paid more and more money, it was because of my vision that they paid me, not because I shot it photojournalistically. It's because I was adding my style to it. And my style includes the way I light things. And I think it's so important for us to really understand lighting so we can actually release our vision. And we need the tools to release our vision. And a lot of times, if you don't have the basics and you don't have them down, then our vision is just bottled up inside us and we just get frustrated.
Well, how does one go about creating their vision or even developing their style?
Well, what you first have to do really is get the basics down so you know it like the back of your hand. So if you want to learn off-camera flash, you can do it. If you want, you know, the Rembrandt lighting, you can do it. If you want split lighting, you can do it like without even thinking. You can pull that off. And then after you get all those things down, it frees your mind so you're not just bogged down with all the technical aspects. And that's when you can really release and just experiment with things. Look at magazines. I love looking at movies, actually, because the movies, the lighting in a lot of movies is amazing.
I don't label myself as being an artist. Mm-hmm. I come from a very technical background. I mean, I started doing product photography, which is
okay.
I mean, it was very technical, and you got to make sure that the lighting is dead on. You don't have reflections. You're paying attention to those little details. And when I started moving into people and weddings and things, I was taking that knowledge and trying to apply it. And by looking at how other people shoot and how other images that I like look, I could dissect that and go,
yes,
I know what makes for a good looking image. And as long as I could recreate that, then I learned how to shoot it. And to me, that's how I kind of came up with what I personally like to shoot, was based on what I did technically. Now, other people may have a artistic vision and need to learn how to do the technical side. I just kind of came about at the opposite angle.
You know what? And I think that's the normal way, because I teach a lot of students, and of course, in every class, there are some that are just very creative and like, oh my gosh, that was amazing, that pose was amazing, or whatever. But I think the majority of us, I was the same way. I didn't even think I was creative until 10 years ago. I was a very technical person. I was a math major and all that route. But it's like, if you can dissect what you like and figure it out, you hit it right on, is that if you can dissect and figure out why you like it, then you can recreate it. And then you can start to add everybody's style and put it into yours. And that's how you do it.
So I always recommend people look at different magazines. Every time I go into a bookstore or even the grocery store, I'm always looking at covers. I'm looking at Men's GQ, Esquire, Cosmo, you name it. If there's a person on the cover, I'm looking at it to go, okay, where was the lighting? I look for the catch lights in the eyes.
Yep.
I look for the shadows. I'm sitting here going through your online gallery, and like there's this fantastic shot of, it looks probably like it was maybe Hawaii, and a girl is sitting there with the water just above her chest, and there's a shadow coming in from one side, so I can see where the lighting was. Now, maybe that was natural light, maybe it was some additional light, but I can see how you positioned it so that the shadows fell a certain way. And I always encourage people to do that. Don't just look at it and go, oh, that was a great pose, but also look at it in terms of, where was the light? How many light sources can you find? Odds are a magazine cover is not going to be a single light source. It's going to be multiple light sources. So where are those lights coming from, and how many are being used? And once you can dissect that, then try and recreate it.
Definitely. Yeah. And I did the same thing. I would just look through magazines. The first thing that I look at is the catch lights. It's like, okay, where's the light coming from? And you can also tell in those catch lights what type of light, sometimes if it's a ring light or whatever, or very large light source, or a square softbox, or whatever it is. And that's really the way to do it. And that's the way I did it. Just looking through fashion magazines, the things that I liked, and figuring out the light, and then just kind of creating my own rules for that and putting it together. And so through that whole process, because I love the education process, what I love to do is take something that's very complicated and bring it down to simple steps. So that's what my posing, let's say that's what my posing lecture is on, is like a very few basic principles based on what I've kind of gathered and looked at and filtered through, and then I've distilled down to, because I was a math major, right? Everything is a formula to me. Some very basic building blocks, and then I start from there and then build it up. But I do the same thing with lighting. You just start with the basics and build it up from there. I think when a person wants to become a photographer, they get discouraged real fast because they try to do it all at once. And it's kind of like, you just go with baby steps, don't worry about it. And then all of that stuff kind of falls into place. But learn the basics first and then build up from that.
That's a great point. One last question I have for you on your lighting is, what type of modifiers, if any, are you using? Are you using softboxes, umbrellas?
I'm a kind of a destination photographer, and I have to keep everything light. And so what I usually do is I have a few gels, CTO gels, and then to give me kind of a warm light if I want it. And then on top of that, to modify it, I usually just use an umbrella.
Yeah.
And that's it. And I usually do a shoot through method. And that's why I bring an assistant with me when I shoot. It's my voice activated light stand, right?
Ear bowls, yep.
and that's how I set it up, because it's simple and it's fast. I'm always concerned about speed and simplicity. and kind of that's what I teach.
Yeah, I really like the Zumbrella from Westcott. It's a shoot-through umbrella that just collapses down to about 20 or maybe 12 inches.
Right.
Opens up really big. Easy to throw into a suitcase or camera bag and always have with you. So great tools for things like that versus...
Like, big. Go ahead. Well, I'm sorry, I cut you off.
Yeah, but go ahead.
When I'm looking for things, I'm always looking for things lighting-wise that are 20 inches or below because that's what fits in a suitcase.
Yep.
So my stands are those Monfrados. I forgot what they are now. They're 001Bs.
The ones where the legs fold back up.
Yeah. 20 inches, you know. Umbrellas got to be under 20 inches. Whatever I can throw in a suitcase is like, okay, I like that.
That's terrific. Scott, I really appreciate you coming on. I mean, I think we've got a lot of good information. We could probably talk for another hour. So. you know, I'm sure I'll have you back on again. We'll talk about some other things. But I want to give you a chance to talk about some of the things that you've got going on. You've got workshops all over the place. We've already mentioned the master lighting guide to flash photography package that you got. But where can other people find you and where can they go to some of your workshops?
Well, if you're in the California area, I'm doing 8 one-day workshops in the San Francisco area and 8 one-day workshops in the Los Angeles area. And so if you go to scottrobertworldtour.com, you can find me there. And then also I do a lot of teaching at the PPA schools and all around the country, and one in Vancouver and Texas and San Diego. I believe the West Coast School, San Diego, there might be a few more spots in my class, but a lot of those classes, they get sold out really fast. And then I kind of have my own workshops. I'm doing a workshop with Matthew Jordan Smith in Japan in a couple weeks, and so that'll ought to be good. And then so you can kind of just go to scottrobertworldtour.com and see where I'm at, or just email me or whatever, and I can let you know what I'm up to lately. But if you're interested in the flash stuff that we talked about, you could just simply go to scottrobertmasterflash.com and you can find everything you want about that.
Now, you have a package that includes the wireless triggers?
Yeah, so how it is if you want to get started with a 4-channel budget Pocket Wizard setup, you can get 3 receivers. So that'll control 3 flashes and 1 transmitter that you put on your hot shoe of your camera. And it includes my book on flash for $199.
It sounds like a pretty decent deal right there.
Yeah. So I'm going to actually so right now you get it directly through my website, but when I get a few more minutes, I'm going to actually put that on Amazon too, so you can find it there with my book that's on Amazon too. So but anyways,
again, I'll put links to all this in the show notes so you don't have to try and remember his 50.
And you know what? We're going to give you guys a discount too. So all those listening to this podcast, they're going to get a 10% discount, and we'll figure out a code for that, and you can put that on there too.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, we definitely appreciate that. We love getting discounted products from our guests. And, you know, it does look like a great package. If you go to scottrobertmasterflash.com, there's a video there that shows you a lot of things that are in the system itself, and you know, some examples of what you're going to learn.
And I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity to just kind of share my thoughts on the whole thing. And it's a definite privilege to be a part of your show. And anything that I can help you with, just let me know, and I'm here.
Excellent, Scott. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Once again, I'd like to thank Scott Robert Lim for joining us today. As he mentioned, you can all get a 10% discount off of any of his things that he's doing using discount code CAMDOJOX, CAMDOJOX, and you'll get 10% off his learning guide at scottrobertmasterflash.com, 10% off his one-day workshops and mentoring program at scottrobertworldtour.com, and anything else that he's got going over there. Be sure and use the CAMDOJOX discount code for your 10% off. Again, thanks to Scott for being on the program. Really appreciate it. We'll put all of his links in the show notes, as well as all the links to Camera Dojo at twitter.com/CameraDojo, facebook.com/CameraDojo, and myself, your host, Kerry Garrison at kerrygarrison.com or twitter.com/Kerry Garrison or facebook.com/Kerry Garrison. Anyway, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.